When author Dave Eggers learned one of his books had been banned in Rapid City, he got on a plane and he brought a film crew. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, November 19th. This is In the Moment. Ahead on the program, a new film documents the anatomy of a community book banning. Or was it a community book banning? We'll hear from author Dave Eggers about arriving in South Dakota and finding a community of readers. We'll also welcome filmmaker Arthur Bradford, and we'll talk with him about the film and what it might be teaching people on the coast about the First Amendment in the middle of America. Plus, how teachers find and measure meaning. We will explore why teachers matter on today's Teacher Talk. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In May 2022, a troubling item on a Rapid City School Board agenda gained national attention. Five books, representing more than 350 copies of individual titles, were listed as to be destroyed. The books were part of an optional reading list for senior literature students. The Circle, by author Dave Eggers, was on the list. Eggers is a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a Newbery Award winner. Well, here's what happened next. Dave Eggers wanted to meet the people banning his book. He'd never been banned before. So he flew to Rapid City to hand out free copies of his book and others to high school students who wanted to read it. He took filmmaker Arthur Bradford with him, and what they found was not necessarily what people on the West Coast expected they would find. SDPB covered the events as they unfolded. In the Moment's coverage was recognized with a regional Murrow Award in the news documentary category for that story. Author Dave Eggers returned to the Black Hills this weekend. It's one of his favorite places now. Mitzi's Books hosted him for a reading, a Q&A with fans, and a book signing. Then he was at the Dahl Art Center for a screening of To Be Destroyed. The film documentary chronicles the Rapid City book banning controversy. SDPB's CJ Keene was at the events. We'll hear from him in a moment. But first, I wanted to bring you my latest conversation with Dave Eggers, this time alongside filmmaker and author Arthur Bradford. Now, a note for listeners, I did have trouble with the audio quality on this recording. You're going to hear a noticeable buzzing noise on one of the phone lines. Please know it's not happening in your head. It's on the tape, and I couldn't get rid of it. Here's Dave Eggers.
I love Rapid City. Like, it's I think I have as many friends there as I do back home here now. It's the thing that we realized right away was that it wasn't the community banning these books. It was a very, very small group of people that didn't speak for the rest of the community. Yeah. And they did so without even one authentic parental complaint about any of the books. They just pre-banned them. Yeah. And so what we found out really quickly was that there was nobody in Rapid City that supported book banning. We couldn't find a person. We couldn't find an authentic parent that wanted books banned. I mean, or maybe one, I think. And so what you find a lot of times with book bans is that it's not a grassroots movement, it's an astroturf movement with outside groups like Moms for Liberty that make lists of books, and then they send the list to, you know, somebody that's willing to submit these complaints who very rarely has any real stake in the school system, and then they gin up some trouble, and then, like in the case with Rapid City, the community rises up and says, we're not going to ban books. That's not us. That's not American. It's been very gratifying to see sort of everything turn out pretty well in Rapid City and everything kind of course corrected.
Arthur, tell me when you first started talking with Dave Eggers about this being a film.
I have known Dave for a long time. We were old friends, and I had just been in touch with him about doing a documentary about any one of the projects that he's involved with, and this came up pretty quickly. He got in touch with me and mentioned that this was happening, and I said we would love to try to film whatever we can, and within a few days, we were on our way to Rapid City.
What kind of conversations, Arthur, did you have with him about getting it right on film? If we didn't already know this in South Dakota, and I could give you a ton of examples that would tell you why we already know this, but especially during the pandemic, there were a lot of national people who came with cameras, with notebooks out, who never came back to South Dakota, but who put us on the cover of whatever publication, you know, they had for a story that they thought was gripping. We didn't always show up in the most flattering way. So what kinds of conversations did you have that said, we need to get this right and treat these people like real people in a real community who are solving real problems?
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, and that is exactly the conversation we had. We were very aware of that phenomenon of people airdropping in and spending a short amount of time and trying to confirm a preconceived notion about a place. So I really tried to come to Rapid City with our eyes open and look to learn from the people there and not sort of check the boxes about a certain conception of what is happening in Middle America. One thing I've really noticed, not just in making this film, but other films I've worked on, is the pandemic had a profound effect on this country. And I think we're still processing it. And I think it had a lot to do with what happened in Rapid City. If I could fault the film in one particular way, it's that we didn't get enough of a diversity of voices in Rapid City. I would have loved to have spent more time there and really learned more about what people were thinking. But it was really important to me to try to tell an authentic story, not to just push an agenda. So in particular, we didn't want to be seen as just Dave's film crew. We were an independent film crew. Dave was doing what he wanted to do in Rapid City, and we're looking to tell a story that was not just only from Dave's eyes.
Dave, what did you want to do in Rapid City?
The first time I came was just by myself, and I was writing an article for the Washington Post called Anatomy of a Book Ban. And I just, because this was the first time I'd ever been banned. And so I really wanted to break down how it happens. And pretty quickly, we, you know, got hold of internal emails, and we realized that the three principals of the high schools in town had decided to pull, you know, a lot of books from the shelf. One of the quotes was, "Let's avoid issues proactively," and that was after a new school board had been voted in. Mm-hmm. And so a slate of new board members with much more hardline views, none of whom had kids in the district, I should note, came in, and the principals, I think, thought, well, some of these books might be objectionable to this new school board, so let's pull them proactively. And that was really enlightening to me. It wasn't even a complaint from a parent, from anybody. It was a proactive book ban to avoid problems maybe in the future. Mm-hmm. And that just shows the chilling effect that can happen. Mm-hmm. And it also shows that principals and administrators have to have backbone. And they have to believe in the freedom to read. And most of all, they have to believe in their teachers. All of the books that were banned had been assiduously examined and approved by committee after committee. Like, the process to have these books weren't even assigned, the five books that were banned. They were optional for seniors in advanced English classes. So the likelihood of more than a couple kids choosing any one of these books was, like, low. So to take this very formal, very thorough process to approve all of these books and throw it to the wind and say we're just going to pull them is an insult to all of the teachers and all of the committee members, everybody that put in all the work to make sure that these were good books for the students and appropriate, too, for their age group. They just threw it to the wind. And in every community in the country where book bans are happening, they are throwing away processes that have been there for decades, sometimes a century, you know, where there are really well-informed, very thorough processes for libraries and schools so that it's done right if you were ever going to say this book isn't appropriate for that age or group. But they're circumventing all of these processes, and that's what's kind of saddening, especially mm-hmm. since the teachers work so hard to make sure that they have the right books and that they know how to teach them. And then suddenly, a few weeks before school starts, they throw them away.
There's a point in the film, To Be Destroyed, where you, Dave, are in a classroom and you're talking about The Great Gatsby because that's what this group of students are reading. And they want to talk to you about the book banning. And one of the students says, are we allowed to talk about this?
Yeah.
And I found that to be really revealing.
When we were there at that point, I had recently published the Washington Post article. And then we came in the wake of that. And the teachers were very scared. Because the principal of that school, by the way, who's no longer there at Central High School, the teachers were afraid of what he might do. So we snuck into that school, basically, to visit the students. The teachers were, like, unsure whether or not that would have consequences. And so it showed just how chilling and just how, scared everybody was in that moment. And luckily, we've made it through. And, you know, I'm going to visit 4 classrooms on Monday, you know, the conversation will be freewheeling and open like it should be, mm-hmm. because these are all seniors. These kids are mostly 18 years old. They're all independent adults, and yet for that moment, they didn't know what they could and couldn't say in the classroom, and the teachers, too, were unsure. Mm-hmm. And so there's a weird byproduct of these book bans, which is, in the case of Central High School, one of the best teachers and the most senior teachers and beloved teacher was disgusted by all of this and left and went to another school district where she could have freedom. And she's still there now, nearby. But we have to give teachers the freedom to be the creative, well-educated professionals that they are. And if they don't feel like they can teach freely, then they move on to a new district that will give them that freedom. So there's no coincidence that the states that ban the most books, namely Florida, has the highest teacher shortage. So there's a one-to-one relationship. We have got to treat teachers better and allow them to be free to teach as they see fit.
Yeah. Arthur, how have people outside of South Dakota been responding to this film?
I think a lot of people have a very positive impression of the, especially the students in Rapid City. They talk about how thoughtful they found the students in the film. It's like what you were talking about earlier. A lot of the times I've screened this film have been in coastal cities. We've screened it in New York City and San Francisco. I like to think that people come away a little bit enlightened. They are happy to see that there's a discussion going on in Rapid City, that people want to process what is going on behind a book ban. I think they come away surprisingly happy about what they're seeing going on in Rapid City, I guess.
Yeah. How did you get people to open up to you on camera?
I'm a parent myself. I have two daughters who are in high school. And I think it's a reasonable discussion to have about what books you want your kids reading and what's going on with teachers in schools. And I'm aware that there is a strange undercurrent in our country right now where certain communities think that teachers have some sort of agenda to quote, indoctrinate our kids. I'm aware that that sort of rumor exists, and I wanted to hear people express that. I was genuinely curious. It wasn't just me as a filmmaker looking to gin up a story. I really have that genuine curiosity. What I love about being a documentary filmmaker is the camera allows me to ask questions that maybe I wouldn't be comfortable asking just in a regular conversation.
Yeah.
A lot of the times when I conduct an interview, I'm holding the camera down and I'm trying to make eye contact with the person that I'm talking to and just try to have a real conversation. I really want to know the answers to the questions I'm asking.
Yeah, I like that.
There was a moment, you know, outside one of the school board meetings when there were, you know, 3 people that we ended up speaking to in sort of a chaotic round robin of conversations that some were on camera and some not. And 2 of the people were there from far away. They had come to speak on behalf of, you know, four book banning organizations, and it was very clear that they just dropped in to this town and didn't know anything about it. And then there was one mom who actually had kids there, I think younger kids, and she was very worked up at first, and then we found middle ground within about 4 minutes when I said, I agree that not all books are for all ages. And she said, oh, you do? And she couldn't believe that. And I said, well, of course, I'm a parent too. My kids are teenagers. And there's a lot of books that I don't think they're ready for. There are the right books for the right age. And within 4 minutes, we were friends, you know? And so there's this polarizing dialogue that happens. You know, maybe it's online, maybe it's in the media. And then once you're face-to-face with another human and you both start off with the predisposition to agree and find common ground, well, you'll find it pretty quickly with 99.9% of people. And that's what everybody found in Rapid City. And that's and actually, you know, when they turned over their school board and the new school board members are much more moderate and you find that they're more invested. They actually have kids in the district. Imagine that. You know, there's a new teacher on the school board, which of every school board has got to have an actual public school educator on it. And now, you know, it's a moderate school board that's doing the right thing, and they're staying out of the way of teachers' lesson plans, and it's a much calmer place. That common ground is always within reach if you look for it.
Yeah. And you can't prevent other children from having access to a book that perhaps you wish wasn't in the world.
Starting with the Bible. The Bible is one of the most banned books. When you look at the history of banned books, the Bible's in the top 10, always, because there are some people that don't believe it belongs in school. I disagree. I think the book, not to be taught in school, but I was taught the Bible as literature in my suburban Chicago high school, and I loved that class. I love the Bible as a piece of literature. I get inspired by parts of it. I look at it all the time. And I would fight to the death to make sure that it's available in schools as another book. Yeah. Same with every religious text. We have to be able to see all of these books that people are inspired by and are guided by. They all belong in school, just like every book should be available. And so you can't take any of it out of the conversation. And the Supreme Court has ruled again and again, you cannot, like, just pull books from shelves because one or two people object.
Yeah.
That's not how it works. You don't pull them. You can say this is better read by, you know, older kids, but you can't pull them. You can't eliminate voices. You can't eliminate points of view. And we had a great meeting with a bunch of students and parents and teachers and pastors at the library, and I said, give me just one book that absolutely doesn't belong in any library. And I thought somebody at least would say Mein Kampf. You know, I thought, like, well, that's the one book. And they didn't fall for it. They all knew the trick. Nobody would put one book forth that it should be eliminated from the library. And no matter what we disagree on, and politically, it seems very clear that the overwhelming majority of Americans will not tolerate this kind of censorship. They don't. It's in our blood. It's in our bones. We get it that reading must be, we must be free to read what we want to read. Everything has to be in the library and available, and you can't eliminate voices from the chorus of humanity and history.
Yeah. Dave Eggers, I'm so glad that you're one of us now. You frequent South Dakota Visitor.
We'll be back because it's a pretty short flight from where I am, and I just love the country, and this is my kind of place. I love open land. I love to see, you know, a beautiful little town surrounded by natural beauty that's been well preserved and taken care of. And so it's exactly my kind of place.
That's Dave Eggers. He is the author of the book The Circle, written for adults and young adults. The book was at the heart of a book banning controversy in Rapid City in 2022. Eggers is also the author of this year's Newbery Award-winning title. It's called The Eyes and the Impossible. That is a book for younger readers. The film documentary To Be Destroyed follows the Rapid City book banning saga. And the other guest you heard there was the film's director, Arthur Bradford. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB's CJ Keene was at Mitzi's Books and at the To Be Destroyed film documentary screening this weekend in Rapid City. He joined me with a recap from the audience.
First and foremost, at Mitzi's, it was a completely different vibe. It was so much closer to a celebration of literature than it was a worry about the impending doom that is books being banned. He read from a still unpublished book that he is working on.
Nice.
He did a little quiz for the kids, which, might I add, I got 6 points on that quiz. And
out of 100?
Out of 13.
Oh, okay.
And he gave out copies of his books to young readers, and it was really just a nice thing to do, especially encouraging them to write.
Yeah.
Now, at the Doll, things were just a little bit different because they were doing the screening of the To Be Destroyed documentary, which you can find for free on YouTube.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was a discussion, a lot of conversation about how the community reacted to that. And it was a big, overwhelming call to support, at least from this audience.
Yeah. So at Mitzi's, how many people were there? What was the you said it more of a celebratory event, but I'm curious, and also I want to know what he's writing about next, like what he read from. So take us to Mitzi's first, and we'll dig into the film screening a little bit more.
It's a sequel to one of his younger reader books. I would say that there was probably 30 to 40 people there, mostly families. It was pretty quiet.
All right. So now take us to The Doll and the film, the Arthur Bradford film, To Be Destroyed.
So To Be Destroyed, again, definitely worth watching. It's on YouTube. MSNBC Films produced this, and Arthur Bradford, a very sharp and intelligent filmmaker. I was very privileged to be able to talk with him. But up there, it was definitely more about the teachers and the students and their experience as they navigated this book situation.
Yeah.
One of the audio clips that I pulled for this is a English teacher at Rapid City Stevens High School named Sean Bradley. And I think he's able to summarize in very few words kind of exactly what they're feeling at this point in time.
When we are in the classroom, we see in a very real way how marginalizing language and book bans and things like that affect our kids in a very, very real way. I've always approached it from the perspective of individual liberty. Why are you okay with the government telling you what you can and can't do in this instance?
Alongside Sean Bradley is another Sean Heft, who is now 19 and is a very active voter and writer. He explains that it was a challenging situation just being right in the middle of it, even if he didn't fully appreciate the situation as it was happening. He says, looking back, it was definitely tough.
When you pull that away from us and you say, you can't be like that, it was nerve-wracking. You know, things are going to go downhill again. We're going to have to stop being the people we want to be out loud. It was scary, even if I couldn't quite feel it all the way at the time. And the books are very important to me.
So Sean, it's important to note, identifies as a homosexual person, says that they want to write as a living, and I don't know, they have a very sharp mind when it comes to these things and is planning on studying English at Twin Cities U as soon as possible. And I just think that their words really rang true to what a lot of the students in the audience were feeling. It was a lot of thank you for supporting us as we fought through this.
That line in the film at the end, it is hard to understand just how many people there might be like you until you see it written down. Because somewhere out there, if you see someone who says, I think like this, and I feel alone, well, I think like you too. And we are community together.
So was there any kind of tone of what happens next or how these things need to be addressed in the future?
The big tone of what happens next is that a lot of the alarmist members of the school board are now gone. Many of them have been replaced by people who are open advocates for keeping libraries and classrooms free to have what they want. People like Jamie Clapham and Michael Berkland, who were elected in that cycle immediately after this whole fiasco started. That creates a change in and of itself, and they're featured in the documentary. And one thing that the filmmaker said to me, so he's from Portland, Oregon, and it really stuck with me how he said, I think on the coasts, we have a preconceived notion about South Dakota, the same way South Dakota might have a preconceived notion about the coasts. And I was shocked to find that most people weren't really looking for this drama. Most people wanted their kids to have access to books. Yeah. And he says that he's going to carry that along with him. I think that's something that personally I'll be carrying with me.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Perhaps every one of us wonders at times whether or not the work we do each day has an impact. Well, teachers feel those doubts too. For today's Teacher Talk, we're going to dive into research about teacher efficacy, how to measure it, and how all of us could reflect a bit more on the power of a good teacher in our own lives as well as the lives of our children. First, a few notes about our guests. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She teaches at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls and is on the adjunct faculty at the University of South Dakota, the University of Sioux Falls, and Augustana University. She is a recipient of the Milken Educator Award. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member at the University of South Dakota and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services in the School of Education. We'll begin here with Dr. Wilbur.
I was thrilled with our conversation last week, and Gina, I hadn't read any of that research that you shared, and so that's what inspired this week's discussion, along with the completely unrelated memoir from Ina Garten.
Everybody's reading this, though.
It's so good.
Just met somebody. Is it a good book?
Yes. I listened to the audiobook, which she narrates, which I always love when the author narrates their own memoirs or their own books. And so she's delightful to listen to. And the book is Be Ready When the Luck Happens. It is a great story. The entire memoir I highly recommend. But I latched on to one piece at the very end where she was talking about when she got to meet Emily Blunt on her cooking show, Be My Guest. Yeah. And Emily Blunt spoke about when she was a child, she had a strong stutter, which I did not know about her.
She's Mary Poppins now, in case
yes.
you don't know.
Lovely. Yes.
And in The Quiet Place.
The Quiet Place. You are right. Yeah. But I have not seen that.
With the guy from The Office?
That's her husband.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In real life. Yes.
Oh.
So she's in The Quiet Place. She's
Is
in Mary
he in
Poppins.
That movie too?
He's in the first one.
Oh.
And then she's also, you might know her from Devil Wears Prada. So,
oh,
in case you don't know who Emily Blunt is, there's you're now caught up.
I suspect, and I'm never incorrect, that you're far too old to give in to imagination. No, not yet.
Perfect. Yes, thank you for doing that. I feel like I should have done more research on her prior to telling this story.
No. I'm just a fan.
Yes, I love that you are. She's fabulous. But the story she tells Ina Garten when she was on her show is that she had this stutter that was quite pronounced as a young person. And she had a teacher point out to her that she did not stutter when she spoke in different accents when she was goofing around with her friends. And so this teacher notices this about Emily Blunt and says, you should audition for the school play. Mm-hmm. And she does and goes on to become an award-winning actress and also rids herself of her stutter through this process of falling in love with acting. And as I said in the blog and as I'm re-experiencing right now as I'm recounting this story to you, there's just some stories that hit me right in the heart when I hear them, and that one did it. I just thought of young Emily Blunt's teacher seeing her and noticing this pattern that she had of her stutter being gone when she was in these goofy accents and playing around with her friends and deciding to say something to her about it and encourage her to explore that.
Yeah.
And then all that blossomed from that conversation that teacher had with
just noticing.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just noticing and saying something.
And we don't, before we get into all the juicy research, and there is plenty, there is research aplenty in the companion blog at sdpb.org/teachertalk. Jackie, the power of the story that goes along with the data. We should tell those stories about the teachers that made a difference in our lives.
Absolutely, we should. I think that I can, as always, only speak for myself. But there are so many days where I tell myself the story that what I do doesn't matter, or that I'm not moving the needle or not helping. And it's easy to go there quickly because there are many problems. No one is arguing otherwise.
Yeah.
And so we have to hold on to these stories like this to remember that teachers matter profoundly in the lives of young people, and that what teachers do is incredibly important. It's important every day. And you never know when that moment in time yields that kind of story. You know, you don't always know that the story is happening in the moment, right? Mm. You're doing what you do every day as a teacher, which is paying attention to your students, encouraging them, noticing what you notice to help them bloom into who they're going to become.
Yeah.
And so I've never met Emily Blunt's teacher, so I don't know what that moment was like for them. But I know that every good teacher has countless stories every day of just saying, hey, I'm noticing you're doing this. Have you thought about this? Yeah. I see this in you. Have you seen this in yourself? Those kinds of things can change lives. And they also can be a Tuesday at 3:45 p.m., right? And so you just don't really always get to know how they turn out. But you're absolutely right. I love the stories of where they end up. Yeah, thank you for saying that.
The author, Kao Kalia Yang from Minnesota, was at the South Dakota Festival of Books this year on a Sunday. And as she was addressing the crowd, she said, I want to be, you know, when I meet you in real life, I want to be the person in your story that is a character I would like.
Oh, I love that.
So she was talking about all of us having our own stories, and then we go in and out of each other ones. That was how she reminded all of us to be kind in the world, that you're going to be a little part of somebody else's story. Be a character that you would like to read in the book.
Mm-hmm. Such a great way of looking at life. Yeah. It really is. Yeah, it
also,
really is.
Also, when you hear somebody's story, it changes everything.
Mm.
So we can come to quick assumptions about people. We can have people stereotype. But then when you hear their story, all of
that's what Rebecca Peterson said. If you haven't heard that episode of the podcast where she takes the time to hear all of her students' stories.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell me your story and listen to it.
Yeah. And she does it in a very structured way, but it also happens in an unstructured way.
Yeah.
Teachers hear their students' stories just while a coat is being zipped up and they're walking to recess, and
ooh,
it can change everything.
Yeah.
It absolutely can.
That noticing. Mm-hmm. How do you make time for the noticing when students are coming in and out, they're testing, they're turning things in, you're grading papers, you have a million things to do, and this teacher took a minute to notice that, oh, when Emily is doing a silly accent and play acting with her friends, maybe I should tell her to try out for the school play.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make time for noticing?
So one of my favorite phrases, and you can sub in the word that you need. So I'll use noticing in this moment. But when you don't have time to notice, notice all the time.
Mm.
And that is a phrase I use in a variety of – I sub in the word noticing for a variety of different things in my life. But I really think that that is the key here, that – and to remind yourself you are noticing all the time, especially as a teacher. You are doing that. And to notice that you are noticing maybe would be another way of looking at it, right? You are hearing Emily and all of these other students do all of these things all the time. You are there. You are paying attention.
Mm.
And so to just remind yourself that that is what's happening and that it matters, I think, is the message that I wanted to communicate today or to talk about today.
When you don't have time for noticing, notice all the time. Say more about what you mean by that. I get the notice that you're noticing, like pay attention to what you're noticing, but if you don't have time for it, do it all the time.
Right. I think that there's just the sense, what I mean by that is to say that not only do you have time, but the fact that you're telling yourself you don't have time means you need to be doing it all the time.
Okay,
sure. If that makes sense, that you getting caught up in the all of the things that we can get caught up in is what's making us feel like we don't have time to notice.
Yeah.
And so then if we start noticing all the time, then that's what makes the space for it.
If you don't have time to breathe.
Start breathing
all the time.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Which is just to remind yourself that you already were, right?
Yes, exactly. You can't compartmentalize that. It is integral to your entire day.
Mm-hmm.
Gina, what would you add to this?
You know, it's true that teachers and really most professions have a lot on their plate, a lot to do. I think it's vital that you learn how to prioritize and decide what has to happen first and what can happen later. And also, what can you cut out? What can you cut out? That's a big thing I did, especially with regard to how much I assign, how much I grade. That's what worked for me. And that allowed me to be 100% with the people in front of me. And that's my little motto, right? I'm going to be 100% with my students when they are with me. So I'm not sneaking away to check email. I'm not quickly grading a few papers while they're working on something else. I want to be 100% with them. And all I can say is that that feels good. And even if I'm just walking around the room, making laps, that feels good to just be with them.
Yeah. I like this, the ordinary, the idea that this is an ordinary moment, that she is noticing a profoundly ordinary occurrence in the daily life of a teacher is how you have it phrased, Jackie. And it gives me such a warm feeling because I think about just in a classroom, as a parent, when you drop your student off, it feels like you're, you know, sending them into, you know, this building where they disappear and you don't know what's going to happen. They come out at the end of it with homework, you know, or with a story of something, you know, that upset them that day or a sticker that they're happy about. You don't always have an idea of what's going on in the classroom. But when you write it like that, I just think of all the ordinary things, that the being present with each other, the family that is a classroom, of what it means to be a class together, what it means to be first graders.
And how much that matters.
Yeah. And how much that matters and how much that's part of your child's life. That's easy to forget as a parent.
Yes.
I think
it's easy for all of us to forget. We are fast moving. And so that, yeah, there was something about that story that helped me slow down to think about the ordinary moments and how important they are.
Simple pleasures.
Let's dig in to some of the research because there is a lot of it. Jackie, where do you want to begin to talk about, we say teachers matter. We could put that on a T-shirt. and you know, wave a flag that says teachers matter. But in the context of this, you are really talking about evidence.
I was. One study that I think I'll just, it's an easy highlight. It was done by the RAND Corporation, and it found that teachers matter more to student achievement than any other aspect of schooling. And I think that that resonates with people as a true fact, but it's helpful to have a study that says that that is true in order to reaffirm that to teachers that their role is vital, right? If that wasn't true, then we could do schooling in a very different way. And not saying that other options aren't viable or are strong options, but it more than the curriculum, more than socioeconomic factors, more than location, more than all of these other demographics that we can measure, the teacher is the item, according to that study, that raises student achievement.
That is so encouraging. And also, if I were a young teacher, I'd be so excited. And then so I would feel the pressure. Like, you better be good. Right? You better be good at your job. You're not going to phone this in.
Right. I can also just add, being in the teacher preparation role that I'm in, being part of administration in higher education in the School of Education, I can say that everyone feels that and is sending that message to our teacher candidates along the way. we know that this matters. And I think other teachers know that this matters. People who are preparing teachers know that this matters. Administrators know that teachers matter. And parents know that teachers matter. And I think mm-hmm. we are all actively invested. And that, to me, is incredibly encouraging because it sees the – for me, it reminds me that we are all on the side of the child. We are all cheering for our children.
Yeah. Good. And with that, when we're on the side of the children, cheering for the children, I want to bring back from a previous episode we recently did, we also maintain high expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we give kids more options and opportunities in life. And that is why I teach. When people ask me why I teach, it's because I want to give people more options and opportunities in their life. When people don't have options.
I love that reason. Mm-hmm. Love that answer.
It covers it all. And now listen to this. And when people don't have much for options and opportunities, they become desperate. And what do desperate people do? Desperate things.
Mic drop.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing is for society, for the whole community.
Yeah.
It is one child at a time, but we're making investments in one child at a time. Teachers, we'd never realize the dividends of those investments. Instead, the dividends are given to the whole community.
Mm-hmm. They are.
And I love that.
Yeah.
I'm glad I can be a part of that.
More research here in your companion blog, Jackie, which talks specifically about Black students, and a study from Johns Hopkins University about why teachers matter for these kids, from who they see at the front of the classroom. Unpack that research for us a little bit, please.
Mm-hmm. So it also relates to what Gina was just saying, the piece about having high expectations. That was another outcome of this study, was that when teachers hold students to high expectations in 10th grade, they are more likely to have a higher GPA in 12th grade. And so there is this correlation between teachers holding students to high expectations because they have hope and optimism about mm-hmm. that student's future. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. that piece of this research was specifically studied on Black students having Black teachers. And I want to make sure I'm getting the numbers correct here, but the study found that when a Black student has one Black teacher before they enter third grade, that student is 13% more likely to go to college. Mm-hmm. And when a Black student has two Black teachers, the percentage almost triples to 32%.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So who is at the front of the classroom and who believes in you matters.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of halfway there last week when we talked about this. And then this week it was like, oh, aha, the light bulb kind of dings on, because it was about the piece where it's like, it's not just a rah-rah, like, teachers matter thing. It's not just, oh, we know they're important. It's we have the evidence to reflect that they are doing the work. So as a parent, you don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's incredibly important. Like, you send your kid to school and they come out knowing something and it becomes almost routine.
Mm-hmm.
And what you don't see is the teachers who are teaching the material, evaluating mm-hmm. in more ways than just test scores, whether they were effective teachers, and this child is learning and growing. Are there ways, my question then is, that teachers can share that evidence with parents? I don't mean like a folder or a grade book, but in communicating during conferences, when I come and sit in front of you, how can you tell me that my child has grown this much? This was my goal, your goal for her, and that we were successful, and here's where... Because I don't know that I ever really got it going through conferences.
I'm glad you're sharing that, all of that. I would say that, obviously, I don't speak for all teachers. I would never claim to. Mm-hmm. I would say that... Collectively, we want parents, guardians, and the community part of the educational process, and that we feel in teamwork with all of you. We feel that we are all doing this together, and we want to answer any questions and work with you, your children, and the community to support, and do not want to feel separate, or is that you drop them off and then see them at the end of the day and there's no, you know what I mean, that there's a mystery that happens there.
Yeah.
And so I would, one, encourage folks who have that sentiment that you're talking about to feel welcomed and invited into the school process in any way that feels comfortable to them, whether it's going to the literacy night that your school holds, or going to the school play, or going to parent-teacher conferences, or sending an email to your teacher, any way, honestly, that you feel comfortable engaging, that engagement is highly welcomed. And all questions that you would have about those things that you just described, whether it's what your child's grades are, or how are they making progress, or in what areas and in what ways can I support my child in their learning, we would want to work with you. And mm-hmm. I don't speak for all educators in that I'm not trying to put words into anyone's mouth, but I think that sentiment is a pretty universal among educators, that we want you to feel included as part of your child's learning.
Yeah. And to be clear, I felt included by every single teacher from kindergarten through high school, and even really some college professors. But I just don't think I made the, I don't know.
I think it just didn't
click for me until I'm reading this and I'm like, oh, that's right. They were. Does that sound dense?
No, maybe not at all.
A little bit like.
I think that a really great step that we've taken is at elementary schools, and I believe middle schools now, at least in the district I teach in, we have more of a standards-based report card. Mm-hmm. So it's not the little report card I received, which just had, you know, reading, writing, math, social studies, science, A, B, C, D, or F. It's rated 1 through 4, and it's all these different writing skills, all these different reading skills. And then the whole report card shows what it was for quarter one, what it was for quarter two, quarter mm-hmm. three, quarter four. And so you can see that growth. And some report cards, I'm not sure if it's in my district, but some report cards will also report on things like attention to the task, or, you know, helpfulness in the classroom.
Sure. Yeah.
Those soft skills that lead toward professionalism.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Likewise, if your student isn't getting a concept, how do you know whether it's the teacher's efficacy that needs to be addressed, or whether it's your student is struggling with something, and bring that up with your teacher? What are the ways that you would say that to your teacher? Hey, my kid dislikes reading, for example, or I just can't get them to read at home. How would you start a conversation when maybe the teacher can grow in the teaching of this task? Maybe there's something I could be doing at home.
Yeah, if I send an email home about a concern, the most important sentence in that email, and I keep it short, is, what advice do you have for me?
Sure.
I know you are your child's number one teacher, your child's first teacher. What advice mm-hmm. do you have for me? And I think that can go vice versa. If I were to send an email to my child's teacher,
yeah.
What advice do you have for us so that he can see more growth?
Sure.
And the real question underneath this efficacy piece is, do we all believe here that this child can grow in this area, mm-hmm. right? And so I think just a reminder that the answer to that question is always yes. We all believe that this child can grow in this area that we're working on. How and what do we need to do is the actual question. So
there's more to this conversation online. You can stream, download, and subscribe to SDPB's Teacher Talk podcast. It's available on podcasting platforms. We have links to the research on our companion page, sdpb.org/teachertalk. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on In the Moment, more history being made in South Dakota politics. The news is coming fast this fall. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.
Cover is not the work, so open it up and take a look. Cause under the covers one discovers that the king may be a crook. Chapter titles are like signs, and if you read between the lines, you'll find your first impression was mistook. For a cover is nice, but a cover is not the book.